So count to 10.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Okay, we're interviewing Antoinette Roselle. Tony Roselle was elected first to the Montana House of Representatives in 1956, served in both the Montana House and Senate. I believe you were the only woman in the 57 session?
57, and I was not married then, so I was Antoinette Frazier.
You were Antoinette Frazier then, okay.
Right, correct.
And Tony, what motivated you to run for the legislature?
To be honest with you, I always wanted to be... I read about Teddy Roosevelt, for one thing. I was very inspired by him. I gave a speech when I was a junior in high school about him. And I thought, wow, that sounds like a pretty neat deal, too. You know, he was out for, you know, the right, fair, and all that kind of legislation. So when I got back to Billings and was here for a while, and I noted that there were no women running on the Republican slate, and I thought, well, gee, maybe I'll try. So I started running really in 1954 when I first got back. I think it was 54. And of course, I didn't know the ropes then.
Now, where were you back from?
Oh, I came back from Europe.
Oh, okay.
I was back from Europe. I've been over there studying in Norway. So when I came back and saw this empty of women, I thought, whoa, I'll run. But the most important thing you have to remember when you run for, and you probably remember that, is that you need to contact all the important, in this fact, Republicans, so that they know who you are. It's very important. So anyway, and I was quite behind in 1954, but then I ran again in 56, because Phil Goen, who had been the representative, part of the Straight Eight, he decided he wouldn't want to run. So he came to me and said, Tony, I'm not running. Why don't you try? Which I did and was lucky.
But most young women then, I think, wouldn't have decided to run for the legislature. That was unusual then.
Very unusual, but I did a lot of unusual things. In a way, my dad was very independent. He wanted us to be that way. He really wasn't sure I should run. He said, you know, there'll be smoke-filled rooms. And I thought, what are they? You know, what are smoke... He knew more about politics than I did. I guess it was kind of unusual, and I...
But it was, you were inspired as much as anything by Theodore Roosevelt's example?
Or? I really was. I was very impressed in learning of his history, to see what a remarkable man he was. And I thought, well, that might be something one should do. I did think that women should be part of making decisions that affected other people. And certainly legislation does that. So that was kind of where that is.
Now, of course, Roosevelt, T.R. Theodore Roosevelt, was the trust buster.
Correct.
He was the guy that that felt that big corporate interests had too much of a dominating place in society. In Montana, when you arrived in the legislature, there was the feeling, at least on the part of some, that the Anaconda Company was this big, eminent power in the legislature that maybe dominated our state and it's in the legislative process. Any thoughts about that?
Well, yes, we would hear about all the people and so forth, the different industries and so forth. But, you know, I never felt any pressure about any legislation. And I don't even know how much in, legislation that they suggested. I don't recall. Black lung was one, as I recall, and there wasn't seem to be any opposition to that one. I'm sure there were others that I can't remember offhand. The railroads also were pretty busy. I talked to a lot of people who were working for the railroads that wanted a change, such as the Gandhi dancers.
Yeah.
And they wanted a covered conveyance if they went from one place to the other. It was very interesting. So they weren't the only ones. Montana Power also was one, although none of them, I didn't ever feel any pressure.
Yeah.
Like, not that you're asking that question, but...
What I think I was asking was that, Theodore Roosevelt was the trust buster, and he was someone who impressed you because he stood up to power and tried to do the right thing.
Right.
And so when you arrived in the legislature, Did you notice that there was this big, powerful corporation, and did you resent it, or was it kind of invisible?
I would say it was kind of invisible. As I said before, there weren't a lot of laws that I remember that pertained directly to the Montana Power. Certainly later on, Montana Power, but at the Anaconda Company. I don't remember anything specific, I have to be honest.
Did you
Bob.
Get the impression that sometimes, you know, obviously business interests don't like to have to pay high taxes? So maybe in a general way, the corporations wanted a good business climate in Montana, which would have meant few regulations and low taxes. And maybe that was just, maybe it wasn't so much specific legislation, it was just that that's the direction that they may have tried to point the state. I don't know.
No, I think that's correct. The one big argument we had, and I was sort of opposed to it at that moment because it had to do with clean air, and it was a big fight. And my opposition to it was that you bring in a company like
Horner Waldorf.
Yes,
the timber company over in Missoula.
Exactly. Yeah. They brought them in, they gave them land, and all of a sudden they discovered there was a lot of smoke and coming from the factory, and they were going to add on, what, $1 million or something, which they'd have to pay, and I didn't think that was fair. Now, obviously, I was in the minority, but I did feel that if you're going to bring somebody in, you better give them all the information. And, of course, it meant jobs, but years ago, the Anaconda Copper built downstream, downwind, because they knew exactly what was going to happen. But the paper company was not allowed to do that. See, they were put in another place, which is ridiculous. So it added to all the other things, like the burning of the wood and all that kind of thing.
There was some competition between Kalispell and Missoula for that facility. And the people in Kalispell grumbled and grumbled about it when it ended up being built in Missoula. And then after they'd gone down to Missoula, a few times after the thing was built, there was feeling, well, maybe this wasn't that bad after all. So.
Well, you know, and I do believe in clean air, and I think recently the Republicans did too, but what I felt was wrong is that you don't bring a company in and then spring that on them.
Yeah.
You give them an idea that, look, this may happen, you better think about it.
Yeah.
So that was the only one big thing that I wasn't in agreement with the Republicans.
So when you first got there you are, a young woman, 1957, you're the only woman in either house, right?
No, there was Bertha Streeter.
Oh, in
wonderful
the Senate.
Senator, yes.
From Lake County in the Senate.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, she was she had been the president of the county assessors, I think.
Okay.
She was great.
Did she take you under her wing a little bit? Or?
Well, I would sit in the Senate and listen to all the information. You know, then, when I first came into the House, this is interesting, we had one microphone for two.
Yeah.
The Senate has a microphone in the middle of the aisle, and they had to go down from wherever they sat to give any information, you know, to talk on the town. Well, you can imagine some of these older fellows that are from the rural areas, they left it up to the lawyers and others who were speakers.
Yeah.
And I always thought that was kind of sad because you didn't always know what they were thinking.
Now that, I wasn't aware of that. So eventually, of course, the Senate was wired so that there were more microphones, but then, if you wanted to speak from a microphone, you had to go to a central location in the chamber to speak.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, and so that obviously would mean some people would just never say anything.
Never say anything. And so what basically we had was the lawyers talking about most everything, and others would agree or disagree.
Yeah. It was a very male-dominated world. In the House of Representatives, you were the only woman there.
You know, I was treated so fairly. I was a colleague, and of course I had one vote like everybody else. They couldn't have been nicer to me, you know. They were great. I did not feel any sense that they were upset with me or anything else.
No, sure.
But I had one of the guys from the legislators from Yellowstone County, Christ was his name, Charlie Christ. He said, "Now, Tony, I want to give you a word of advice." And I said, "Okay." He said, "The thing for you to do when you're a freshman is sit down and listen, and don't do a lot of talking."
Well, that's time-honored advice. A lot of us have received that same advice, that's for sure. So there were hospitality rooms then.
Ah, yes.
And I think the Anaconda Company had one, the railroad, I believe, had one at different times, perhaps the petroleum industry and that sort of thing. And as I remember, the Anaconda Company hospitality room didn't include women.
Actually, we were invited, Bertha and I were invited, if they had kind of a celebration for somebody's birthday, and they'd have a huge prime rib, which was wonderful.
Yeah.
And we would go up and, you know, join in, and then we'd, you know, go on our merry way. I don't remember the other, now some of the other people, like, I mean, the other groups, like Montana Power would have a big dinner.
Yeah.
And I think the railroad, I can't remember about the railroads or not, but John Willard, as I remember, was a lobbyist for the railroad, wonderful guy, and was very influential on knowing all about Montana. He had been a newspaper man and then was a lobbyist. But I don't remember that, I did not go by myself to any of the rooms because that was, I wouldn't do that. Number one, I thought you had to be really careful as being the only woman. There have been other women before, obviously. I think I was the 13th. Not sure. So, but you just had to be careful. And I didn't think you should be seen drinking or any smoking even.
Yeah.
So you had to, I guess, put up a good image.
And did you introduce a bill?
I did not. I did not. I was not a chairman of the Committee of the Whole, which you have a choice to do. I just was a little bit nervous about that, so I never would. When I was in 61 and 63, it was no problem, or when I was in the Senate, but somehow I just couldn't get myself up there.
Now, you came back in the House in 61 and 63.
That's correct. And in 61, there were three of us, three Republican women. There was Helen Johnson and a lovely lady from Missoula. I can't remember her name. Maybe you could. She was very highly regarded in Missoula.
Bess
Reed. Reed. Perfect. Yeah, thank you. Tried to think of her name today. And then in 1963, there were two of us, both Republicans, Joy Nash and I. And Joy Nash was the one who had a legislation that made one of the units out there in the, I can't think which building it was, into a DUI recovery type of situation.
Okay.
Yeah, she was very responsible. She felt that it's true, alcoholics were becoming a real problem. And they were no longer considered drunkards, they were considered alcoholics, people who could not control their situation.
Yeah.
So this was great to have at least a public facility they could go to.
And that was her...
That was her bill.
Her special
right.
legislation.
Mm-hmm. Special legislation.
Now, in 1961, I believe Ted Schwinden was a legislator. Is that right?
60, or was it 57?
You remember serving with Ted Schwinden?
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
Yes, I do.
He might have been there in 59 and 61, or it could have been 57 and 59, but I think it was 59 and 61.
Well, yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think now.
You served with him anyway.
I believe so. Yes, I did.
Any impressions?
No, he was, I don't know. It was amazing. The Republicans and Democrats got along very well, actually. And I don't remember any problems at all in any time. Just can't help you out there.
You served also with Tom Judge.
Yes, I did. He was a good legislator. I liked Tom. Tom was a good governor when he agreed to sign the Equal Rights Amendment. That was good. That was very good. But, Schwinden, I thought, was a very fine governor also. And he was, you know, he had his doctor's degree, I think, but he never discussed it. So.
He was a political scientist, I think, went to the University of Minnesota or something. And
well, you know, I don't know the background, but I just know that someone said, well, he has his doctor's degree, and I'm going, oh, I mean, you know, yes, it would have been an educational degree.
And let's see, were you in the legislature with Tim Babcock?
Yes, in fact, my first session in 57, Tim and I were seatmates.
Really?
Oh, he was wonderful, very helpful, and he and Betty were so nice to me. They would take me to lunch because here I'd be by myself. Actually, in those days, I was not invited out to lunch. I would bring my own lunch. which would be a egg salad sandwich and carrot strips. And I wondered where everybody went.
Huh. You think that the lobbyists were just kind of uncomfortable because you were a young woman? And
I don't know. I've never asked that, how come you didn't invite me kind of thing, you know. But you know, when you take something from someone, you feel there's an expectation, and I would not have been in favor of that.
Yeah.
I think you really had to. This is the one big problem I see today with running in politics, is that you have to ask people for money, which makes you a little beholden. And I remember that when I first ran, I paid for all my own. And of course, in those days, it wasn't quite as expensive. We ran countywide. And consequently, we had a lot of help from the, once we got into the Republican Party, you know, we were the nominee and so forth, then we got a lot of help. But it's very hard to run on your own money.
Yeah.
Because there isn't enough anymore.
Oh, yeah, now. And in a big media market area like Billings here, it costs you $15,000-$20,000 bucks.
I used to have little, like, 57 seconds and stuff like that, where you get in 25 words. But that's changed.
Oh, that's for sure. No, the cost of, and I think politics has become more partisan and it's become more expensive.
It has. I will say this now, going back to women and my interest in it. Okay. What happened, I think, in 1972 with the new Constitution and the Equal Dignity Clause, the fact we had 10 women delegates out of 100, I think made a very big difference. And actually, our own Constitution, you know, has an Equal Dignity Clause, which is equal to the National Equal Rights Amendment. And since that time, I've noticed, like in 67 was my first term in the Senate, and there was a lady from Dillon, and I can't think of her name. She was a very nice lady. And then she felt that she was having trouble walking. And I don't know if she had MS or not. But anyway, she did not run the next time. So in 1969, I was the only woman in either house. And then I think in 71, I'm not sure when Dorothy Bradley was there.
But 71 was her first session.
Yeah, she was the first, she was the only woman in the House, I think, and yes. I was the only woman in the Senate. I'm not sure about that being the only one. There might have been a lady from Great Falls in the Senate.
Oh, there was a lady by the name of Hall, Boots Hall.
Barbara, but, yeah, right, Boots Hall, right.
I don't know if that was 71.
Yeah, I think that's who it was. Yeah. It went along those. And then they gradually kept increasing, which was wonderful. Yeah. And now I don't know what the...
Now, when was the Equal Rights Amendment in the legislature?
That was 1973 and 74. We had annual sessions.
Yeah.
Okay. It was introduced in 73.
Okay.
And it went through the House. The prime sponsor there was Senator, well, at that time, Representative Reagan. And it went through the House, simply. It got into the Senate, and I was a co-sponsor with a gentleman from Great Falls. AUW was pushing this amendment. And our amendment stayed. We didn't pass our amendment. It was tabled. Our amendment was tabled. In fact, everything was tabled. So we had the two, basically, I think, the two legislative pieces, the two amendments, tabled in the Senate. And then Bill Mather came back in 1974, and he said his daughters had given him some very interesting advice or explained to him the circumstances that he wasn't aware of. And he gave a big newspaper article to one of the huge newspapers, Monitor, Christian Science Monitor. So he stood up in the Senate and said he thought it was a good idea.
So he had been voting against it in 73 and switched to vote for it in 74?
Well, yes. Actually, there was really no vote on it, see, because it was tabled. There was
oh,
no
I
vote.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah, see. So it was with his advice. He may not remember this himself, but I'm sure he will.
Okay.
With his advice, it was came off the table and was passed into the House. Passed the Senate. It was a Senate bill, I do believe. It was passed the Senate and went into the House and was passed there. Well, you were there.
Yeah.
Weren't you in the House then?
I didn't remember the details of
it
you just did, but so
I'm
then it
sure
went on.
Because it was annual sessions.
Yeah.
It was probably the one big reason that amendment passed. And the big help of Bill Mathers, because he was so highly respected.
Yeah. But did for some reason, I'm thinking that it surfaced again in the late 70s, and I'm wondering why that would have
been
the case. Well,
here's the thing. A lot of people were upset with it because they felt it was going to make a huge difference. But it didn't make a difference to Montana because we already had that
in the state
amendment.
Constitution. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And but they were upset about it. And so what they try to do is rescind it. Well, you don't do that.
That's what
you
happened.
Don't rescind
okay.
it. See?
Okay.
And my husband even came over to testify against the rescinding.
There was an effort to rescind it. When would that have been?
Well, it was probably a couple of sessions later.
77 or 79, maybe?
I think so. Well, it could have been, it would be 75. Could have been 75. I think it might have been. I can't remember now. But it was in the, I think it was later. Right, I think you're right. They kept bringing it up. And then we did, according to our own Constitution and the Equal Dignity Clause, we equalized all of the genders. So that was where the bill on promiscuity came up, is the fact that if it's a guilty act, both parties are guilty.
Yeah.
And that passed through the House. Senator Reagan and I introduced that bill. And there wasn't much conversation about it, actually, on the floor.
No. In fact, I think I remember something about the joke. What are you going to do about, what should we do with the prostitution bill? Well, maybe we'd better pay it.
Oh, that was good.
Remember that?
Yes.
That was
there are a lot of jokes. I tell you what, I wish I could remember them all. And I remember Pat Regan said, now, Tony, don't say anything unless you have to. I mean, if the Republicans say something opposed to the bill, maybe you should respond. And I said, okay. So anyway, when the president of the Senate, no, who would have been the chairman of the Committee of the Whole, said, the bill is before you. What is your pleasure? And Pat said, would you like to rephrase that? Oh, she was full of friends.
She was a character.
She's got that Irish humor.
Yeah, she really does. So did you work with Dorothy Bradley on any legislation? Do you remember?
I didn't. I thought she was a very outstanding legislator because she introduced the a bill dealing with abortion. And she had, I said, Dorothy, are you sure you want to do that? Because there's a lot of feeling about it. And well, she said, Tony, if my constituents think I should, I should. And I said, well, good for you. I mean, that shows you a real, true legislator, really. Someone who believes in their constituents and upholding what they believe. She had a lot of threats on the phone. I mean, she had some real unfortunate, I think, responses, obviously, to it, but that was about the only legislation that we had a conversation about. Of course, we were pretty much for everything else.
Yeah, and that, of course, that was in 1971, and I think the legislation she introduced would have, in some way, legalized abortion in Montana, and that preceded the 1972 Constitution and the Roe v. Wade decision, because her legislation was defeated. But then later on, of course...
Gotcha, right. Yeah. It would have allowed abortions to take place legally.
I think that was what her bill would have done. And it was, and as I remembered, it was defeated pretty overwhelmingly in the House of Representatives. And then 3 or 4 years later, it became the law of the land as the result of the Roe v. Wade decision in the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, see, the thing about abortion is nobody's for it, really. But it's such a personal thing. It should be done on a personal level with a doctor, husband, and so forth. It's the kind of thing that will go on. We don't stop it.
Yeah.
It'll go into, like they used to say, the alleys.
Yeah.
People would use unfortunate ways of aborting.
Yeah.
And so that's the big problem. And it will continue to be the problem. No one's, it's not going to be something that'll be solved very easily.
Well, and in fact, I think it remains maybe the most divisive issue in the country as we conduct this interview. Right now, the Supreme Court has a vacancy. Sandra Day O'Connor has resigned from the Supreme Court, and both sides are saying they want a mainstream person on the Supreme Court, but the real issue is whether the person is likely to vote to rescind or repeal or whatever the right terminology is, take back the Roe v. Wade decision or reaffirm the Roe v. Wade decision. That's really
yes,
the
that's
only
good,
real issue.
Right. I'm sure it is, and it's it devastates, really, in a sense, both parties, because there is no real answer to it, in a way, as long as you have that kind of opposition growing all the time. Sometimes it just gives stimulus to certain groups to react. Yeah, I don't know what the answer is, but...
Now, you know, our party, the Republican Party, tends to generally be pro-life on the abortion issue, and the Democratic Party tends to be pro-choice on the abortion issue. Any thoughts on that? Has that made you uncomfortable?
Actually, I was asked, when they had the platform group here, what was that, at the beginning of, I think, 5 years ago or more, when Bush was elected, okay, they had a meeting here, and I was asked to present the pro-choice attitude of Republicans. And so there is a group of women who are, and men too, I'm sure, who are pro-choice. But what my position was, what I wanted me to say was, no matter your position on it, it should not be a plank in a political platform. And that was the main issue right there. And it made sense to me. And I can remember when I ran for office one time, that I was asked, now are you pro-choice or pro-life? I'm going, well, I'm kind of for both. I believe in pro-life, but also people have to make their own choice, which is pretty much where the issue is, yeah. I think, at this point.
I think that's where the general public generally is, too.
Right. Yeah, it's such a delicate question for people, that for couples, for young women, and men too, that it's hard to be able to decide how that's going to come finally go. Now, I think Judge O'Connor, certainly, by the way, she was serving in the Senate in Arizona at the same time I was serving in the Montana House. And so she's an outstanding person, and she made some very nice comments to on the Today Show. I thought they were very good when she was being interviewed by Katie Couric. So important, because she said how the responsibility, how she felt went to be the first one on the Supreme Court, and that this was a scary part of it in many ways. And when you asked me about being the only woman in 1957. It wasn't really scary. The guys were so nice and pleasant and gentlemen. Of course, that's what they are. They're the gentlemen. And, of course, I will say that Tim Babcock was a very good friend, very very helpful. He also, by the way, was a legislator in Miles City. So he had that kind of outstanding background.
Some additional background.
Exactly.
Now, if you were approached by a young woman today told by her that she was interested in running for the legislature as a Republican, what advice would you give her?
My suggestion would be, find out where you are going to be running and how they vote in that area, because that's where it is. With the districting, it's so much different than countywide. You know, and you have to pick up maybe 500 votes or something.
Yeah.
And you're running against somebody, and I think it's more difficult right now to run in districts than it was, in a sense, to run the county, because you kind of knew, you know, where you were going on that.
And I think also the partisanship that we've discussed is more intensified in the single-member districts, because if you get a district that's more or less safe Republican or more or less safe Democrat, then you can follow, if you've got them, you can follow your extreme tendencies and get away with it. Whereas if you've got to represent all the people in Cascade County or Flathead County or Yellowstone County, you've got to be maybe a little more, take a little broader view of some of these issues.
That's exactly right. I remember when I ran the first time and won, there's a big thing that said, open meeting at the Labor Temple. I thought, oh, that'll be a place to go. So I presumed everybody was going to be there that I would know. I got there and I didn't know anybody. Willard Frazier wasn't mayor then, but he was a big supporter, of course, of Democrats. And he spotted me in the back and he said, ah! He said, there's a namesake.
Because what?
My namesake, one of my namesakes, because it was Antoinette Frazier when
sure.
I first ran.
Yeah.
So he had me come up and speak. And the questions were, do you believe in right to work? What do you think of the Fiery Tail, which was the Yellowtail Dam? And I said, well, I think everybody has a right to work. And I said, I kind of agree with Mr. Fiery, with Congressman Fiery, that the Yellowtail Dam is questionable because I don't know that they'll be able to do all the four things that they plan to do, which right offhand I cannot remember right now. But
yeah.
When I used to work at Eastern, and the geology teacher said, Tony, those walls are porous. They're going to have a heck of a time keeping that water in there. Well, I think we know that. But anyway, I think my experience there, because after the meeting, several of the members asked me to come down and have some Coke, so I had a Coke with them. Now, they said, you're right. We work beside people that don't do the same job we do, and we get paid the same. He said, so we believe in what you said, that everybody has a right to work. Anyway, I got some votes there.
But you didn't necessarily tell them what they wanted to hear either, from the sound of it.
No, I didn't. Yeah. No. See, that's a good point. You have to do what you think is right. And when I vote, I was the only one of our delegation that voted against the resolution for the Yellowstone...
For Yellowtail Dam.
Yeah, Yellowtail Dam, yeah.
And that apparently, that was considered an issue that really hurt Orvin Fiery?
Yes, it did. It did.
His reluctance to support Yellowtail Dam was...
Yes. Yeah. But he was really, I think, correct, what they found out now. I mean, it's... And actually, the water goes down to Wyoming, which is interesting.
Yeah.
And, of course, it is a beautiful... When the water is up, it's a beautiful area to fish and have sports and so forth. And I'm sure it helps all the farmers down the road a piece there, but...
Now, do you remember, the big labor leader in the state at the time, I think, was Jim Umber?
Oh,
any
yes.
Recollection of him? The AFL-CIO or their presence in the legislature?
Oh, yes. I didn't notice them in the House. But when I went to the Senate, now this would be in 57 yet, I think, wasn't it? If I remembered right, was 57?
Well, 57 is when you started in the House.
Yes, it is. I'm trying to remember them. They were quite in evidence, I will say that. And I do remember them when I sat there in the Senate one time when I was still in the House. I looked up and there were these three people above the clock. And I said to my friend, who are they? So, now I did not notice them.
They were labor leaders.
They were labor leaders, right. And I said, oh, those are the three labor leaders. And I said, oh. And they were quite ominous, if you want to know. They were like this. They just were sitting there looking at everyone, you see. But they made a mistake. And I'm not sure this should be something that I could say. It was hearsay, actually, but... They threatened one of the senators, and from that point on, they never appeared. And it was interesting, it was a Democrat senator. And that was one of the things you learned very quickly, is you did not discuss your colleagues with anyone, and that you certainly, the lobbyists knew, you did not ever attempt to change, you know, to use any kind of force or, you know, verbal.
Was it as a result of some kind of an issue
Yes, I can't think what it was. I don't remember now what it was. It was actually, he was a doctor and he was from Helena. But I don't remember what it was about, to be honest with you. In fact, the doctor...
Cashmore was the doctor from Helena, yeah.
That's exactly it. And he was the one, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. And then, let me think here. Umber was someone I never actually knew. I think he was there in the 50s and 60s, but Jim Murray replaced him.
Yeah, and it may not have been Umber. I can't remember who it was. Was Umber a truck driver?
Joe Crosswhite and Jim Umber and Jim Murray were all kind of there at about the same time.
They
kind of
crossed
over
I'm not really sure, to be honest, which who it was and what the circumstances exactly were as to who said what to whom, but... The story was that you just don't ever call up a senator and suggest they made a mistake.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Especially if a constituent can do that, but a lobbyist really can't. with all integrity.
Now, do you remember there was quite a contest in 1964 between Tim Babcock and Ted James for the Republican nomination for governor? Excuse me, 1968. Ted James was elected lieutenant governor in 64, and Babcock was elected governor in 64. Then in 68, Ted James challenged Babcock for the Republican nomination. Any recollections of that?
No, I tell you what, I was always so much for Tim. I toured for Tim, as I recall, at that time, 68.
Tim was defeated in 68 by Forrest Anderson, but he had a primary against his own lieutenant governor, Ted James,
yes,
that preceded that.
Yes, well, yeah, I'm sure that's where we campaigned for him. Well, one of the reasons I think he didn't win that, or for whatever reason, was the is because he had said he was going to stick in there as governor, and then he ran for the Senate seat.
In 66, yeah.
There
he said
go.
In 64 that he, I guess, or at least he gave the impression that he wouldn't run for the Senate in 66, and then he did. Now, of course, the big issue that affected Babcock was the sales tax.
Yeah, right.
And that was an issue that recurred a lot of the time you were involved in politics. Any thought on that? Any observations on that?
Well, you're going to be... Actually, I remember the first caucus, and I believe it was 67, and one of our members said there was one thing that he would not do, and that would be vote for the sales tax. He was a fellow from up in the northwestern part. He had Christmas trees. Remember who that was? Anyway, he did not budge from that, and we were one vote. We needed one more vote.
That was in 67.
Yeah,
probably, yeah.
67, right.
See, I should know that, too, and it's a Republican.
Yeah, he was a Republican, and he just simply said he was not going to vote for it. Well, then, you see, they tried to get, they got a couple of fellows, but they couldn't quite make it. But he said he told his constituents he would not vote for the sales tax, and he was not going to do it. And he kept loyal to that.
Yeah. Tony, I'm thinking George McCallum is in my mind.
Exactly,
but that would have been in 71, wouldn't it? Because George and I got there in 70, and we had a big fight on the sales tax again in 71.
Maybe then it was 71, right?
Yeah.
Oh, you're exactly right, 71. Then we had a special session, remember?
Yeah.
And we passed out a bill which was people could vote on, and they really voted it down clearly.
Well, Jim Felt from here in Yellowstone County was the speaker in 67.
Exactly. Okay, there we are.
And he was pushing for a sales tax with Governor Babcock's support. And I
exactly.
think the unpopularity of the sales tax probably contributed to Babcock's defeat also
in
68.
I'm sure it did, because people were very upset about it. But, you know, it made sense. It's still an issue, as you know, from your experience.
Yeah, yeah.
And it probably still will be one.
I voted for it my first session there in 1971, and I became persuaded of the wisdom of trying to reform our tax system with the sales tax as a part of it, and I don't think it's ever gotten me any support. It's probably always lost me support.
Well, but you can only be honest about what you think is important and what is necessary to be done.
Yeah.
The biggest problem is, it does seem, when you see these states with the sales tax, they just keep going up and up and up.
Yeah.
And then they also add in the income tax, which they maybe have not done before. So I don't know.
But you know, the interesting irony there is we've got a upper limit in our state constitution of 4% on any sales tax that we've never had.
That was passed.
So Montana's about the only state, well, literally the only state in the nation that has a constitution that guarantees the sales tax can't get beyond 4%. And at the same time, we're one of the few states that has no sales tax. So
a little confusing there.
That's for sure.
Maybe the next legislature will do that.
That could be, Well, then you were an educator.
I was an educator, and that was one of the things I didn't always agree with the Republicans, because it seemed like, in fact, in 1957, you know, they put the thing over the clock, we would argue, debate, whatever, where to put the money, to colleges or to public education.
When you just said put that thing over the clock, just to clarify here, the Constitution in Montana then said that a legislative session couldn't last longer than 60 days.
Correct.
So it was customary, rather than if the legislature wasn't done with its business by the 60th day, to just hang
a cloth
over the clock.
Right.
And so the 60th day might have lasted 3 or 4 or 5 days until the legislature got its work done.
And I think it lasted, it seems to me, in 57 a week. And at that time, you're not paid for that.
Yeah.
Which reminds me, what we were paid in those days was $10 a day, excluding Sunday, because we didn't meet on Sunday.
Well.
And you see, it wasn't until we got into the Senate and Luke McCune decided that it was unconstitutional to put a cloth over the clock. That could certainly be debated in a court of law.
Yeah.
That it, any of the bills passed at that time were constitutional. So that's when they decided
to
close it off and have a special session.
Have a special session that they had to.
Yeah.
I interrupted you. You were about to tell about public education and the funding of public education and so on.
That always was an argument, but the legislature really wanted to do that. The foundation program was pretty explicit, and one of the big lobbyists in those days was the MEA.
And Dee Cooper was their lobbyist.
Dee Cooper was one of the big lobbyists, and he was very straightforward in what he thought we needed to do. And the foundation program at that time seemed to be the logical thing to follow, but it had to be explained to everybody because it was not as clear. And I think it was explained to me at least 50 times every time we had a session with the MEA, they really explained it. Because it was just hard to understand how it worked out.
Yeah.
And now to find out that it was unconstitutional, am I correct there? But I was very definitely for education, and I did not always agree with the Republicans on education.
And that's because you felt that maybe we could have afforded to spend some more money for education
than
we did?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And the one thing about the foundation program, which is very important, is rural schools got an equal amount so they could get teachers. I mean, they would have enough money to pay those teachers a salary commensurate with maybe some of the public schools in terms of the number of students going. City schools, I should say. But and then the colleges, you see, needed money. So you had that big problem. What do we do with this money at the end? To whom do we give it? Public schools, colleges. And the other debate was kind of interesting, is the one where University of Montana, at one time, the University of Montana was Montana State University. And then it was Montana State College, I think I'm correct.
Bozeman was Montana State College,
exactly.
And Missoula was Montana State University.
Right.
And then Missoula became the University of Montana, and Bozeman became Montana State University.
And the reason for that is that they would get more grant money if they were universities. But see, before that then, Bozeman and Missoula were part of the greater university system.
Yeah.
And I don't know, that's been going through the the ropes, I was going to say, still, you know. Of course, our university has grown so much, I wouldn't recognize it. Being an alumna of it, it's different. Now, are you an alumna of the...
Of both places.
Are you? Oh, really?
Yeah. I was an undergraduate at Bozeman and a graduate at the U of M. Went to both places. Well, as you look back... with the legislators that you served with. You served with Jim Lucas.
Bill Mathers.
Bill Mathers, Frank Hazelbaker, Bill Groff. Any,
oh, yes.
Any thoughts on any of those people? Any?
Well, they're people you remember because
yeah. They
always, they kept things moving.
Yeah.
And they, I like Bill Groff. He was the fellow that knew about finances. The one thing that always amused me, we could argue forever on such things as pro-choice, pro-life, equal rights. But when it came to the budget, we could complete that in about one session. We'd just be handed the information, they'd say, this is it. But see, years ago, we used to make trips into these various institutions and see what they were doing and so forth. But they always had a special committee working on the budget, and it didn't take long to go through that. But it took an awful lot longer for these other things. I always thought that was a little bit strange.
You were on the Senate Finance Committee?
I was not, no, but I just noted that that's what it was.
Well, and I think, too, that sometimes, I noticed this, too, from my own experience in the legislature. If you had a a big bill with great fiscal implications. Either perhaps it appropriated a lot of money, or it had big consequences in terms of raising or lowering taxes. And it was kind of technical. Most legislators would keep away from it. They'd let the people who supposedly knew something about it talk about it.
Exactly.
But if it had to do with liquor, if it had to do with coyotes, if it had to do with silver dollars, if it had to do with firearms, everybody had an opinion.
Oh, yes.
And sometimes the debate would last for an hour and a half or 2 hours.
Oh, absolutely.
And everybody'd have to give a speech on it. But we might then turn around 5 minutes later and pass a bill with a $14.3 million price tag on it that was kind of complicated, and it'd go through in 10 minutes.
I think that's exactly on target, and it was because you felt like you had more understanding of the firearms bill, for example, or whatever. Oh, yes.
And Bill Graf, of course, as chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, was the man who had the best handle of anybody in
and
the Senate.
And he was a banker. We knew he knew about money.
We knew he knew about money, and so generally he was deferred to on some pretty major pieces of legislation. So
yes,
I guess we all believe, and probably still do, that he didn't mislead us on anything important.
Oh, no. I think they did a fine job with what they had, but it was always kind of unusual in a way to think we would spend so much time on these minor things which don't affect people as much as money, you know, income and so forth.
Do you remember Bill Graf strolling down the center aisle to the water cooler?
Oh, I love that, yes. That was very good. And we knew he was getting ready to say something. He was getting organized there.
It was a kind of a ritual. I remember it very well. He sat fairly near the back, I think. And he'd get up and rather ceremoniously stroll down the center aisle.
Yes, very elegantly down, so you knew that he was there.
He walked in a way to be noticed. And he'd go to the big water cooler, a big jar of water, and he'd drink a paper cup full of water and throw it in the waste paper basket and kind of stand there and look carefully at the whole Senate from the front of the Senate and then stroll back to his seat, and then seconds later he'd rise to be recognized.
Yes, I think he was the kind of figure that you would remember.
Well, anything else you can think of? Any impressions or of people or bills or lobbyists or the system or anything that you'd like to mention?
Well, you know, I think it's a great system. Doesn't always work fluidly, but it's a great system. Checks and balances, and that's so important. And I'm sure there are many things that, if I could think of them at the moment,
I'm just going to ask you about a few people as we conclude our interview, and they're people that many people would have known, but just to ask you, did you ever meet Senator Mansfield?
I never met Senator Mansfield, but for some reason, back in 1964, I ran in the primary, Republican primary, to try to, be elected to run for the U.S. Senate, and actually that was when Blewett won that.
Okay.
But I have never met.
So if you'd won that primary, you'd have run in opposition to Mansfield.
Exactly,
in 64.
Exactly, because for some reason they thought there was a chink in his armor, which of course was ridiculous.
Yeah.
He was so smart. Whoever was working for him, they would send cards to everyone on their birthday. I mean, there was no way you were going to defeat. And he was a fine man anyway. You know. But you know how you do. The Republicans think, we have a chance here.
Yeah. Maybe the woman angle would work in this case. Yeah.
I traveled the state of Montana. It was fun. And it was very interesting because you went to all the county meetings and so forth. But there were three of us running and I was third. But it was a wonderful experience. And one of the things you get out of, and I'm sure you feel this way, one of the things, you don't always win an office, but it's the experience of running that is so enlightening and enervating, I think.
Did you ever meet Senator Metcalf?
Yes, I met Senator Metcalf for some reason. I met him. He was a friend of my father's, I think, at one time. I never met Janet Rankin either, which I'm sorry about. I don't know why. You'd think our paths would have crossed.
Yeah. Any impressions of Metcalf from that meeting you had with him?
No, just very friendly and, like a lot of politicians outgoing.
Yeah.
I didn't notice anything specific, however.
There's a new biography coming out on Jeanette Rankin that you probably would be interested in. I don't know when it's coming out. I know that there are a couple of professors at the University of Montana and Missoula are working on it. There are, I think, a couple maybe of biographies that are out on her already. What are your impressions of her, even though you didn't meet her?
Oh, I think she's a fantastic woman. Actually, one of my very good friends, Fran Elgee, was her administrative assistant when she went there the second time, which I think is amazing that she was reelected to go.
Yeah.
Each time during a war, which I think is providence myself.
Yeah. I met Frieda Fliegelman, who was her administrative assistant when she was first in Congress.
Oh, and she was a doll.
And but I didn't meet Frances Elgee, but she was, wasn't she a federal judge or a...
She was. She was an Indian... She was an Indian judge, and I don't remember exactly. There's a different name for it, but anyway, she worked with the Indians in terms
one
of
the one of the first women lawyers.
Oh yes, she was. Her class. I have her class photo, and she's there in this photo. There, a graduation day in the law school, and everybody's wearing a dark suit, and she's dressed in white.
Now, of course,
she was something.
Your mention of her reminds me of. Louise Replogle Galt, and of course her first husband was Wellington D. Rankin.
Yes, that's correct.
He was an eminent personage in Montana politics and Republican Party politics, a big rancher and that sort of thing. Did you ever meet him?
I did meet him. In fact, they were having a big deal at the Placer Hotel. Not sure what year it was. He was the national committee man, and they were trying to defeat him, this little group. They even flew in certain people from the counties. And I don't think he was defeated at that time. But later on, I don't remember how that worked.
What do you remember about him that would have made him
controversial? Well, he was just very stately. And he was at this meeting, and he didn't say a lot. I don't know that I had any big impression of him, really. He was a very interesting man, and quite different than Jeanette, which is amazing. When you think about the two and their political views, I think.
I think they were both brilliant.
I believe so. I believe they're brilliant. And of course, Jeanette Rankin was totally unusual when you think about a woman doing that. Now, when she voted against the war in 1917, I think it was okay because a lot of people from Montana were opposed to the war.
Yeah.
But of course, when she voted against the war when we were attacked, it was a whole different kind of philosophy, which was too bad. But she believed in peace, and that she kept that in her mind all
and
the time.
And she stuck to her principles, no question about that.
She really did. She was outstanding in that respect, which was not easy to do because she had to run into a phone booth, you know, to protect herself, which seems almost unbelievable, really. Politics is pretty wild in those days.
I'm sure that's true. Jim Batten.
Nice guy. He was a class ahead of me at senior high.
Okay.
Very, very fine man. Very fine man. Married a good friend of mine, Barbara Batten. And I thought he was a very good congressman. And I'm sure as a federal judge he was too. I didn't have much to, you know. But
now I only just remember him a little bit in the 60s when he was a congressman. And he seemed to me to be kind of a low-key kind of a guy.
He
remember him at Republican state conventions a time or two, and he was a very tall man, kind of slow-moving, kind of slow-talking, kind of thoughtful. That's at least how I remember
him. That's correct. And when he would come, he would give us information about what was going on, which was, you know, he didn't try to influence us with any political. He just said, this is what's happening. You need to be aware of this. And that I liked that. I thought that was a very good thing to be informative.
Yeah.
To me, that's the best kind of a speak.
Yeah.
So that you know what's going on, and he would do that, and you got him right on. He was very methodical and a thinking guy. So I'm sure he was a very fine federal judge also.
Senator John Melcher.
Oh, I like Melcher. He was always very pleasant. He served in 57, I think, when I was there in the House. I think he got into some kind of a problem. I don't know exactly what it was, but he was always, whenever I would meet him, he was always very sincere, and I don't have any other comments than that, except that I think he tried to be a good congressman.
Yeah. he was in the Western Congressional District, but he was also Attorney General for a while. Did you ever know Arnold Olson?
I knew Arnold Olson. He became a lobbyist later.
Yeah.
And Arnold was an interesting guy. He was a fellow that, let's see, how did that work? There was a lot of oil controversy at the time when he was Attorney General, along with the lady who was a superintendent of schools, because a lot of public lands were involved. And I don't know, because I think did he run for governor? I can't remember. And he
no, Arnold Olson, let's see, maybe Harriet Miller, is that who was the
Harriet, no, what, no, it wasn't Harriet Miller, it was somebody.
Mary Condon?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was Mary Condon.
She preceded Harriet Miller as superintendent of public instruction.
Correct, yeah. That's correct.
And I think Arnold Olson probably would have been attorney general during the period of maybe that they both were in office.
That could have been, right. Yeah. But I know.
And then Olson ran for governor in 56 against Aronson.
Oh, yes, Aronson. Now, yeah. Aronson was a great guy. Oh, when I was first running, he said, oh, you know, come on, Tony, come and join me. We would travel over to Laurel, and Jim Felt was one of the members of our legislature. And they would take me around. They were very nice. And you learned how to handle that kind of thing. The galloping Swede. On the go with Hugo.
If you were going to describe him to someone who had never met him, how would you describe Hugo Aronson?
Well, he's a rugged-looking individual and very mannerly. His his ability to speak English, you know, fluidly.
Yeah.
But that you didn't mind that because you said the most important words and you knew what they were.
Yeah.
And there's some great stories about him, you know, going through. He had nothing, and he knew how to say, I think it was ham and eggs. So he led a ham and eggs. But he was an amazing man. In fact, Phil Goen his brother. Let's see, I can't think of his brother's name offhand, but anyway, both of them were in the legislature. Their sister, Nancy Goen Dawkin, was big and Republican, and we went to a convention one time and stayed in the old mansion when Rose and Hugo lived there.
Oh, my.
And that was a pretty thrilling experience.
Oh, I bet, yeah. That's
Bill,
a museum
Phil,
now.
Yeah, right. Phil and Bill. Bill Goen, interesting thing. He was flying his daughter and a friend around Yellowtail Dam, and something happened to the plane. And he knew he couldn't bring, it must have hit, you know, something. And he saw a bit of land someplace, and he went down to where that land was, where he could land. And before he landed, he said to his daughter, jump out. You and your friend, jump out. So they jumped out. He was close enough, and then he crashed.
And he was killed in the plane
exactly,
crash, and they survived.
Right.
They landed in the water and survived?
I'm not sure, now that you're asking. I don't think they landed in the water. I think it was some little area they could land in.
Wow.
But he was highly regarded.
Yeah.
He's a terrific guy. He's a good friend of Jim Hoy, I think. Jim Hoy. And he was full of prunes. He liked to drive fast, that boy. But I was always admired him for that because he was very calm. The story is, he just said, when I get to a certain point, you jump. Don't argue, just jump.
Wow.
Yeah, it took a lot of guts to do that.
Incredible story. You also served in the legislature. I think you were in the House when he was in the Senate. I'm not sure about that, but you were in the legislature when Don Nutter was governor.
Yes.
Did you meet Don Nutter?
I met Don Nutter and worked with his campaign group. And I was in the House when he was in the Senate. And he was big on keeping taxes down, and he was an outstanding governor, I think, for as long as he served. And I never could figure out what happened to that plane. It was a very strange event.
Yeah.
And but he was he was a lawyer, and he was able to speak, and he was pretty much really kind of a shoo-in for governor, I think.
Yeah.
He and Tim. Because Tim was very well liked, too. Yeah. Always has been. But it was tragic that Nutter would go, however.
Now, Nutter, of course, was controversial in education circles because, as you mentioned, he was a real fiscal conservative.
Yes, he was. That would have been... I don't remember too much about that, though. I have to be honest, Bob. I don't remember. I just know that he was definite on taxes, and he wanted to be sure to didn't raise them. And, of course, when you talk about funding schools, you very often talk about taxes.
That's right, yeah. You have to talk about those things at the same time, that's for sure. Well, anything else you'd like to mention?
No, I appreciate the opportunity. What happens with this now? What do you do with this?
We'll turn this tape over to the Mansfield Library, to the State Archives, and it'll just be on file there for perpetuity.
So no matter how many mistakes you make, it's going to be right there,
it's going to be right there, yeah. But so much appreciate your public service, and so much appreciate your willingness to do the interview.
It's my pleasure, and thank you for thinking of me, Bob. Good luck.